Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, good morning, everybody. Well, today I'm so pleased that we're going to be able to speak to Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He's a socioeconomic research scholar, and his most recent work is entitled The Elites Couldn't Care Less About Inflation. And naturally, it's written by him, Oren M. Levin-Waldman. So good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning.
You know, it seems so simple what you put in your article, which we posted on Monday, but nobody seems to be talking about it. Is there an issue of who are we supposed to defend? Are we supposed to defend the banking system? Are we supposed to defend the worker? Are we coming up with one excuse after the other as to why things are a mess? Can't we be a little bit more forthright? You evidently are. I mean, I agree with this. It makes sense to me. So what's the problem here?
Well, I mean, politicians talk a lot about inflation. They talk about protecting the public from inflation and,
yes,
you know, taking various steps to curb it. But, you know, I don't know how serious the public officials really are about that. Politicians, I have my sense that they couldn't care less. They're in that income bracket where it really doesn't affect them that much. They feel a little pinch here and there, but so what? I mean, if you pay more money at the pump for gasoline, what's the big deal? And then you hear the same politicians basically saying, well, you know, for those of you who are suffering because you're paying higher gas prices, you know, by all means, either buy an electric car or drive less or, you know, take mass transit, whatever. But, you know, or put more air in your tires. That's the best one.
Yeah.
So you can save money. So, but the attitude really is akin to Marie Antoinette saying, let them eat cake.
Exactly. And so but we can't even afford to bake the cake. That's the problem, too. You know, everything has gone through the roof. Well, why is there a disconnect? Why is it that we don't understand that and that we have forgotten Marie Antoinette's, famous saying, well, they can't afford bread, let them bake cake. And, you know, it's happening again now with the crisis in Ukraine. They grow wheat and oats, the same thing with Russia. People are going to be starving all over the world. And what are we going to say to them then? You know, eat some kelp or what? You know, I don't get it.
Well, what you've seen is an administration which has basically, been able to mobilize the international community with regards to sanctions. The same administration is the one that basically killed the Keystone Pipeline and basically has been waging war on fossil fuels in the United States. And at no point has it come back and said, okay, maybe we ought to reverse that decision, although even reversing that decision would basically be too late because, you know, it would still take some time to get that oil into the marketplace. So it really wouldn't be that helpful. But the symbolism of it, we had, in theory, energy independence. We sacrificed that. We're willing to import oil while we transition to green energy. But we don't, and we're even willing to beg the Saudis to pump more oil and into the marketplace while we are at the same time angering the Saudis because we're willing to jump into a nuclear deal which threatens their interests. There's a disconnect between this administration. It's almost as though what the administration is really saying is the most important thing for us right now is to have a deal with Iran with regards to nuclear weapons. And then, but even saving Ukraine is not that important as far as we are concerned. That's really what the administration is saying. As far as the inflation that's resulting, that's simply collateral damage. And then you have Biden blaming Putin for the inflation, which really is far from the truth. You basically had a 7% rate of inflation before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It went up to 7.9 after the invasion of Ukraine. So most of the inflation is before the war and has nothing to do with Putin at all.
So, you know, I think at the end in your concept and in this write up, you ended up saying that Congress can resolve this issue, but they don't want to be responsible for it. And is that also the president also doesn't want to be responsible for it? Can't he lead the Democratic majority and say, "Hey, this is the right thing; it's going to work"? Or don't we know? Why don't we know?
Yeah. No political actor wants to be responsible for any of this. And basically, so you have two approaches to inflation. One is fiscal. The other is monetary. Fiscal is basically during a period of inflation, you raise taxes to curb spending. And that basically brings prices down. During a recession, you basically give people tax cuts to give more money to spend, so that stimulates demand for goods and services, which invariably leads to inflation. Then the monetary approach, which was advocated by Milton Friedman, basically is you allow the Federal Reserve Board to control the money supply but through interest rates and reserve requirements that the Fed imposes on member banks. So what's doing now with monetary policies, you're basically saying, okay, during a recession, we will lower interest rates, make it more easy to obtain money so you can expand your operations. And also people will be able to purchase goods because it'll be cheaper to purchase those goods because the interest rates are low. During inflation, you raise interest rates. You want to contract the money supply, and you want to make it more expensive to spend money. So that ultimately will bring prices down if you hike interest rates. What it also does is it creates a recession. So the end result is workers whose wages now have been devalued for so long because of the inflation will now find themselves out of work. As the economy contracts.
So who benefits from all of this? Is it just the wealthy?
Well, that's the impression you get. And if you look at the actual purpose of the Federal Reserve Act, it was to protect the banking industry, basically to have stable prices. There was nothing in there about unemployment. Unemployment was a later assumption owing to the Employment Act of 1946, which basically implied that you could create as much employment as practicable if the Federal Reserve Board would lower interest rates during a period of recession. Now, Congress can't demand that the Federal Reserve Board do anything, and neither can the president. What the president can do is try to influence the Federal Reserve Board by holding over the head of the Fed chair the possibility of being renewed as the Fed chair. And that's typically what presidents have been doing for the last few decades. Bernanke may want to keep interest rates low because Bernanke wants to be reappointed. The same was true of his predecessor, and I think the same has been true of his successors. So, you know, this is it has become the conventional wisdom of late that the Federal Reserve Board is responsible for maintaining low unemployment when, statutorily speaking, that was never the case.
So is there any escape from this cycle, which is which diminishes the capacity of people at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder to advance because, you know, they're almost like fodder. You know, okay, you know, maybe 1 month or even a year you'll do, you know, inflation won't eat up into whatever salary you're making, but then it could destroy you and diminish your capacity to buy fuel, you know, like it's cold and fuel costs are going up and gasoline is going up and everything that takes energy to heat your home in this cold weather as well. Is there no escape? Or is the only escape education? And then who do we have left to do the rest of the work? If everyone's going to be earning their $200,000 or $300,000 a year, who's going to do anything else? It doesn't seem to work.
That's the basic conundrum that you have is if you have a political class that basically wants to be absolved of responsibility. In other words, they don't want to face the election in the next election because they're responsible for their suffering, as a result of, tight money. Intended to control for inflation, then this is what you have. You basically have an unelected body, which is making public policy, as is about a group of people who cannot be removed. In other words, once they have been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, they serve out their terms. They cannot be removed by either. And I think this is something that's not really understood by most of the public. Public officials and elected officials understand this very well, and they're perfectly willing to play the game of publicly blaming the Federal Reserve Board, threatening to the Federal Reserve Board by talking about introducing legislation to change its mandate, blah, 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 blah. But they never follow through because they don't want to be responsible for – I mean, you're going to actually hike taxes during a recession, make things – worse for people, take what little money they have away from them. That's what you're going to do. No elected official would vote to raise taxes, and because they'd be fearful of losing their seat in Congress. At the same time, it's not so easy to lower taxes during a recession because we have all these balanced budget pieces of legislation. We have this idea that whatever taxes that you lower, it has to pay for itself. So you have to find the money from someplace. That's the reality that we are confronted with.
Well, so what do we do? Like, for example, if we had more fuel available, then maybe that would lower costs. But then we decided not to go for the oil from Canada, and so we cut that off. And I think Europe, for example, they had an alternative. If they weren't going to get fuel from Russia, I think Israel said, well, we could ship it to you through Greece. They said, no, forget it. We're not interested. And now all of a sudden they're going to they're rethinking this whole process, and now they might put up different forms of power through wind, even though they say wind producing energy doesn't look good, or it might do something to the environment some other way. I don't know which is the right thing or which is the wrong thing, but what's going on? Why can't we come up with a plan that makes sense? It makes sense here. It makes sense everywhere else. Or is there some bias somewhere around here? What are we trying to save?
Well, there's certainly bias, and there's certainly a multitude of the different interests that are affected by different set of policies. So clearly, green energy industry stands to make billions of dollars. That fossil fuels, I guess, in their minds, threatens them. The reality is fossil fuels are on their way out anyway. There's only so much that we have. in Europe.
Right.
So they're on their way out. The question is, was it necessary to shut down pipelines during a transition period? And the short answer is no. It wasn't necessary to do it at all.
No.
In fact, it was probably counterproductive. And we're finding that out now because there is a war going on. And it does affect the supply chain of oil to this country. And that is a problem that we have. And then we're discovering that we really can't force countries, especially whose interests we're working against, to then all of a sudden do our bidding and pump more oil for our behest. I mean, that's the height of arrogance that you're seeing right now. The other thing that many people in the public really don't understand is that it's not just a question of what you're paying for gasoline at the pump. It's a question of everything. The price of everything is going up when oil prices go up. Because,
yeah.
We talked about getting your goods to market. It costs more to get those goods to market. So the price is going to be passed on to consumers for food, for other goods, that everything is basically shipped by truck in the United States.
Yeah.
And if the price of gasoline goes up considerably, then the price of everything else will go up. And that's something which is not easily understood by many people. And the other thing is, if you want to talk about the value of Teslas and other electric cars, these power stations for these electric cars, they are powered by fossil fuels. So again, if the cost of fossil fuels are going up now, then the cost of running your electric car will also be going up.
Yeah, but why did, it never dawned on me also that this is the way the energy process went along, but they made such a big to-do about the ecological, integrity of having a Tesla. But I think the Teslas running around, I think they might have a model for about 50,000 and another model for about 90,000. That's like a fortune of money. People aren't buying. Not everybody can afford that, even 45,000, when they could get a Hyundai for $20,000. So what are we expecting, and who's driving this equation?
Well, the average cost of a Tesla is about $65,000.
Okay.
And the average cost of the gas car is $45,000. Now, obviously, there are cheaper cars, and lower income people end up buying used cars or used clunkers.
Yes.
I don't know if there are any used clunking electric cars on the market right now. So, that's the other problem. No, the issue is it does not affect people who are affluent. It really affects people who are at the lower end of the distribution. They can't afford the cars that are going to be powered by green energy. They will basically be forced to rely on mass transit systems, which have not really been developed in any serious kind of way. When you have discussions in New York City, for example, for congestion pricing, it all sounds good on paper. But if nobody's going to actually make a serious investment into improving the mass transit system, it's not really going to work. And if you're living in one of the boroughs where there really is no mass transit system that will get you from point A to point B, then people are forced to drive their cars into Manhattan. And most of the people who are forced to drive their cars are at the lower end of the distribution, not the higher end.
Well, I used to think that, if you have to go over a bridge in a tunnel to get into Manhattan, then I guess people couldn't afford to do that. So then they went with mass transit, but the amount of time it takes to go with mass transit, it takes forever. So the only people who can afford to pay the congestion pricing are going to be people who can afford to buy the Teslas and the expensive cars, and for them, they could probably take it off as a tax write-off somewhere along the line. So what does everybody else do? You just sit around waiting for a bus or a train?
That's the other hard reality. Those who can afford it will absorb the cost and just go on their merry old ways. They get to some cost of doing business. Those who can't afford it, they're going to be left behind. The ones who can't afford it are the ordinary workers that the elites just really couldn't care less about.
Yeah. It just seems that there should be a better way to balance this all out. Or are we trying to concoct or to create or sustain a difference between socioeconomic standards, and we have the elite and we have the people who are less than that? Is that what we're doing? We're constructing that? It's got to be purposeful.
Well, I've been suggesting for quite some time now that I don't think the elites really care about the well-being of those at the bottom of distribution. It's rather evident in the policies they've been pursuing or the policies that they have not been pursuing, but the reality is they just really couldn't care less. They care about themselves, and it's really all about themselves and their particular worldview, whatever that worldview is, and in some ways it's as incoherent as that worldview happens to be, which is basically coming into sharp focus at the moment, given the events around the world.
So is it naive to think that we can have a more balanced type of system where there may not be that much of a difference between the extremely well-to-do and those at the lowest end, and there's something a larger percentage in the middle? Or are we just not even going to consider that anymore? That used to be like a fairy tale story, and it's never going to happen. We're not going to be able to put it back into the box. We told ourselves that there would be greater equity in our nation, and we don't. We don't have equity between one state and the other, or one community and the next. It doesn't seem to work. But doesn't that create problems, social problems?
Well, yeah, penny wise, pound foolish. But I think the mindset of what you see among progressives in Congress, the Democratic Party, this particular administration is, you know, equity is achieved when you make certain kinds of appointments to the Supreme Court. End of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Equity is achieved when you back things like, you know, transgender in sports, you know, transgender people being able to play on women's sports teams. That's the new equity. Equity is achieved when, you know, you continue to support affirmative action and maybe even critical race theory. But we don't have to address the issues of the economy because those are the problems in our view are so intractable, we can't address them. If you really are concerned about equity, let's start with some basics. Let's start with the basics of the educational system, which is not teaching people equally. With an uneven educational system, a poor K-12 educational system, that's where your inequities are going to develop, and they're going to manifest over time and become exacerbated. So, you know, but this administration continues to talk about equity of outcomes as though the only serious equitable outcome or change in that outcome can be by appointing, you know, the first black woman to the Supreme Court. And the reality is that, you know, she may be qualified, but we would not know that because you made this wonderful statement ahead of time. But what you've done by making that statement is you've engaged in the very racism you claim to decry.
Yeah. It just seems that there are a lot of platitudes out there, but not much in results. You know, we've been fighting inequity in capacity to earn a living, in education. But, well, like you said, okay, so we have one black woman who might become a Supreme Court justice. What does that do? It may elevate her, but may not do much for anybody else. So then it could be, you know, what her political perspective is, not necessarily an equity between people, where there's a balance in the type of education we give people at a young age, and if everyone has an opportunity to get an education. We can't allow equity. Is that really the problem? We need to have people at the bottom and people. Somebody's going to have to pay for it for other people to succeed.
Well, that's the reality of a marketplace, a capitalist marketplace.
Yeah.
Winners and there'll be losers. There'll be people at the top and people at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional liberal public policy, I should say pre-woke liberal policy, was predicated on this idea of leveling the playing field. So you'd create programs which would enable people to be able to compete on an even playing field with others who had the advantages of wealth or born into positions of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we can ever change that. People born into positions of wealth will always be in those positions of wealth. There's really very little that we can do about it. That having been said, we can try to enable those who come from, say, more middle-class backgrounds to be able to go to school, to go to college. We can probably put more money into good quality public university systems so they, too, can acquire the skills necessary to become members of the so-called elite. To the extent that they will be accepted by the elites that have been, you know, came from privilege and prestige and have gone to the elite institutions.
Right. So, well, I don't know if there's any society that's even working on that level. Are you familiar with anything that's happening like that? Or is it too much disparity within every community in every country so that and there may not be even enough money to invest in all of this, or not even an interest to move in that direction.
You know, again, some of the European countries are doing a better job of investing in human capital than the United States is. And they have good quality university systems, which are public university systems, than the United States does. You know, we have a few which operate more like private universities these days, and they're highly selective. But we don't really have a serious system designed to train people to be able to work in the new economy predicated on technology.
Mm-hmm. So is there any way, like when you have a new generation of kids being born and they're going to go to kindergarten or pre-K, can't we begin at that level? And it may take 25 years to build a very exceptional, educated population of every conceivable denomination, however you want to put it together. But you need to have an education in order to be able to excel. And you'll still have people going from, I guess, one subject matter to another. You'll have people in mathematics and sociology and in science and in literature because they'll gravitate toward it for one reason or the other. So there'll be a disparity in earning capacity, but not to such an extent that we have today, where we have so many people who are barely making a living. And things are subsidized to such an extent. Wouldn't it be cheaper for the government to push programs that could work, or no?
Actually, it would probably be more
spending this money
for the government to push programs that would work. Then you still have people fighting over these programs and fighting over what they think they're entitled to. And you still have various interests that will be affected by these programs. Again, We have it's a zero-sum society, so for every winner, there has to be a loser. Someone's going to have to pay the cost. If you say, let's have these programs have more investment in the capital, then we're going to have to raise that money through taxation. Somebody's going to have to pay those taxes for some other group to benefit. Not everybody wants to do that. If you invest more in human capital, then, you may not have the most efficient marketplace because, people are spending more money on taxes, so you have less money for investment. That's the case which you have in Europe. You basically have, more equity in terms of outcomes, but you have less efficiency in the marketplace. So that's the trade-off. We have opted for this higher efficiency, lower equity, which, by the way, when you talk about lower equity, and the end result is you have less equality.
Yeah, evidently. But is it easier for us to have, let's say, a more homogeneous society to have greater equity, but we have less because we define it on color line or ethnic line or gender line, or we have too many ways to tear up our society? Is that one of the problems that it exacerbates itself?
So the problem is basically we have this kind of myopic view of freedom, if that's the term you want to use. So we talk about, democracy, the democratic system. We all have freedom. We have freedom to choose who our elected officials are. We have freedom to live the lives we want to live. But the question one has to ask is, how much freedom do you have to make choices in your life? If you're working a low-end job paying you barely subsistence wages, are you really free at that point?
No choice.
And if you're forced to continue working in that environment just in order to subsist, then you're not free at all. Is that not another form of servitude, to use a bad word, it's slavery?
I think so.
And a lot of people, if they really thought about it, would say that's another form of slavery. But we're not talking about that anymore. We're talking about, equity. This group didn't get into Harvard because of skin color. But the question is, how does this group getting into Harvard necessarily help those at the bottom of the income distribution? It doesn't. And there's a disconnect between the various groups of society. You still have a stratified society. Even those groups that can now be admitted to Harvard because of affirmative action in the name of equity, it's not going to help the masses who are left behind, also members of the same community, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It does nothing for them at all.
Right. Yeah, so it just looks like it's a panacea, but it's not. Because there may be thousands of people who want to get into Harvard, and through affirmative action or any other means, there may be one or two that may get in. And so, that doesn't change very much.
It doesn't change, and then those who are admitted to Harvard, they've crossed the class line.
Exactly.
So they may identify with the class they came from to a certain extent, but do they share their interests? And the reality is probably not.
Exactly. Very, very interesting. So these are very fundamental issues. So why did we go one way and maybe other places went another way? Is that also born in our DNA because of our economic system between North and South? Is that when we began our process here, or did it begin in England and we transported it here to the United States when after Columbus?
Well, the United States does mimic Britain in many respects, and that is the tradition here. It's actually a more extreme version of what you see in England, because rugged individualism is really the defining characteristic of the American experience, where you don't have the same emphasis on record individualism in Britain. In Britain, you have more of a, you know, a welfare state which has developed in response to traditional aristocratic government and a monarchy. But we, you know, our institutions are very similar to British institutions. If you really want a focus on society as a whole, then you need to look, go to the European continent, where there's more of a tradition of, you know, the whole, the group, as opposed to the individual. And there's more of this idea of what people owe to one another and what people owe to society, as opposed to their obligations to society, as opposed to their rights and interests, which is what you find in England and the United States. As far as the economy is concerned, you know, we basically have taken this view because we have been born free of the shackles of the feudalistic tradition in the United States. And we believe that, you know, because of that, there's this thing called upward socioeconomic mobility. We have taken this view that anything that in any way hinders that, like this idea that you should, you know, emphasize the rights of groups at the expense of individuals' pursuit of their own self-interest, that is a no-no.
Wow. So where do we go from here, or is this where we are, and this is where we're going to stay? And so there is – the inequity is what's going to stay, and it may just change due to an individual either going upper or lower than they began, and that's it. And there might be a new technology that may come about that may elevate some people or diminish them, because of the sophistication of the new technology that will eclipse what was. And that's not the way we're going to go anymore. Maybe we're not going to go for atomic electrical power. So we'll find something else. And is that what's going to change within our society?
Well, I mean, technology is... It has its pluses and it has its minuses, you know. In some ways, because of technology, you know, we don't have to spend as much time, you know, cleaning homes and taking care of things to the extent that we used to in the past. It has freed women to enter the labor market. It has freed us to have more spare time to do as we please. That's very nice. So, on the other hand, technology, the cost is, if you are not skilled, then there really is no place for you in this economy.
Yeah, that's become evident. It seems to have become more evident in the last 25 years than I had ever recognized it before.
Well, I mean, again, technology has basically resulted in, you know, you don't need toll collectors on the highways anymore. You have Easy Pass. You don't, that costs people their jobs. You don't need as much of a clerical staff in any operation because you have computers and you have word processors that can do these things. I mean, if I think back to my own experience of writing a doctoral dissertation more than 30 years ago, I did it on a double floppy disk drive. But even that was revolutionary compared to the generation before me, which had to type it up in triplicate on a typewriter and ultimately had to pay a typist to type up the final product. I didn't have to do that.
Right. So, and what did we do when those people that were collecting tolls on the bridges, what happened to them, for example? They were earning a good living. At least I think they were. I have no idea what they got paid, but they certainly they had a good pension and stuff like that. But Once we had Easy Pass, that was all over, and eventually everybody got phased out. And what do we do with that sort of stuff? Or is that just part of the horror of advancement in technology and education? And what do those people do? Do they go on the dole?
Well, the marketplace assumes that they get reabsorbed back into the economy. It doesn't say much about where they get reabsorbed into the economy or what their function will be.
You'll be slipping burgers.
We have to assume that either they went back to school to retrain, or many of us then went into low paying jobs.
Yeah.
Or those of them who were close enough to retirement that simply retired.
And there was no way of knowing 30 years before of late. I don't know when Easy Pass began. Maybe it was 10 years ago. So people 35 years before that would never have even imagined this sort of technology would come about. At least I don't think so. I never thought about it. It's, but there's no way of knowing that things will get disheveled somehow. From what we believe is standard today, may be gone tomorrow. So is there a way to plan for all this, or is it strictly getting an education and then still studying all the way through life?
Well, I mean, again, I think the issue, we need to start with the fundamentals, and that is your basic K-12 educational system, which is not adequate. It's not adequate for even putting people into a place where they can even think to retrain. Retraining probably could be a quick process if people had the skills and basically the foundations in order to be able to take advantage of that kind of retraining. They need to have the basic education and skills to begin with, and many of them are functionally illiterate.
Yeah. Well, we hear there's a lot of hankering going on even for people who help other people because of medical needs, old age or whatever. A lot of them are not educated, and they have empathy and stuff, but they don't really have much education on how to take care of people. But we're somehow elevating people to do that sort of thing. I don't know for what exact purpose. Maybe there aren't enough people to take care of older people who are debilitated one way or the other. But it seems like we are dumbing down people as well. Maybe they just never had the education. Why are we training them to become guards at a bank? They barely earn a living. You know, I don't even think that there's a need for all these security people in the bank. You know, I don't see it. What are they protecting there? Everything's behind. Something that's closed. There's no way to get in. So much security in any bank you walk into. Well, it doesn't look like we're advancing very far, is it?
Well, we certainly haven't advanced too far in the last hour, but...
Well, you know, that's probably very true. It's just hard. It's just a reality, and that, I guess that's the brilliance of your essay, and because it's a reality, and I don't know if we'll ever become woke to it, you know, for the lack of a better term, or if we could do anything about it, because I guess our mindset has been, I don't know, it's like we've just moved in that direction, and I don't think we have any concept of how to change it. We talk about it because we hope that things would change for the better, but I don't have the intellectual capacity to even think how it could be done. And I don't really see much of a change in the socioeconomic ladder. So I know I'm very thankful I had an education. It's probably not the best education in the world, but it's certainly not the mediocre. But whatever the case is, I see a lot of people don't even have that, not even mediocre. So I don't know where things are going to go. And we have more and more people, you know, more kids are being born every day. What do we do with that? I don't know. Well, they say people are having less sex than ever. So I don't know why that is, but whatever the reason is, it's there. Evidently, it's a new fact in life. So maybe it's time to become a baker. Marie Antoinette. That should go well. So any other thoughts?
You definitely have a political class that does not really care about the public, and I think we are seeing that. We are seeing we see politicians simply double down, particularly this administration. They're doubling down the decisions they made. Decisions they made were very much motivated because they hated Trump, so they made these anti-Trump decisions. And then when they come back to haunt them, they don't want to hear about it. So you have a president who walks away when asked questions. You know, like, do you think that maybe Putin was motivated or inspired or maybe you encouraged, we should say, by your haphazard withdrawal from Afghanistan, botched withdrawal from Afghanistan? Oh, no, that was the best decision we made, according to our president, and he doesn't take any questions. I think it's possible he would have invaded anyway. This is something Putin's wanted to do for the last 30 years or so. And he was looking for an opening to do it. You have an administration which basically doubles down. It sends the wrong message. If you announce ahead of time that, well, we certainly will not send in troops to stop you, so obviously then Putin says, fine, that's all I wanted to hear, because then I can go ahead and do it. And if you say, I'll wait to see what you do before I actually impose sanctions, then you're too little too late. Since you are dealing with a nuclear power here, you sort of have to be careful. I think many of us look at this and say, this was probably a very avoidable war. All the United States and the European Union had to say to Zelensky was, you know, we believe that you seeking NATO entry into NATO is a red line for Putin, and you really can't cross it. So that's what we'll tell you now. We're not going to. You said it's not for you. Might have forestalled. At a minimum, if you really want to engage in brinksmanship, which is what, you know, Eisenhower administration did in the 1950s, for 130,000 troops, you see Russia massing up along the border, then you bring 150,000 NATO troops there. I'm sure that would have stopped Putin from invading. If you're talking about a no-fly zone, you don't talk about it now when it could actually provoke Putin to use a tactical nuclear weapon. You should have imposed the no-fly zone prior to the invasion. But this is an administration which leads from behind and still stuck in its idea that, well, you know, we have to pursue woke politics. We have to pursue equity. And our premier foreign policy goal is the reentry into the nuclear deal with Iran.
Yeah, I can't even fathom or wrap my head around the purpose of that at all. I don't know why we're trying to placate them one way or the other, but it's never going to be good. It seems like we're at each other's throats all over the world, more so than ever before. So I just don't see it. And I don't know if America is going in the right direction. with these sort of policies. I think everyone is astounded that America would say it's okay, and to work out an agreement with Iran. Even the Arab countries are just not thrilled with it either. So I don't get it.
Well, I think what you have is a mindset again, which says basically, well, a nuclear deal with Iran, it's better than a war. Even if it's a lousy deal, it's better than a war. The United States is not going to war over this. If they weren't going to go to war over Ukraine, why would they go to war over Iran? And their missiles are pointed at countries closer to them, so the United States is fairly safe. It's kind of the myopic view. It really doesn't understand the region or the culture of the region. But that's the mindset of this administration. Part of the problem, I think, with this administration, as with most American administrations in history, is that you have people who are secretaries of state and national security advisors whose only real training is that they're attorneys. And they went to law school, which means everything is negotiated. So they're attorneys. They went to law school, and everything is negotiated settlement. Everything is negotiable. Well, not everything is negotiable, and only if you don't understand culture would you take the view. You take the view, oh, I'm a rational person. The other person is a rational actor, too. So we can negotiate a settlement rationally. Well, that's true if you share the same cultural assumptions, but we don't.
Right.
We don't understand other countries' history and culture at all. I think the better secretaries of state have been those who've come from academia, who've understood a region very well because they've studied the region well. But that's not the case of most secretaries of state who happen to be attorneys. And this is the mindset. Everything is negotiable. So we can negotiate Iran, a nuclear deal with Iran, because they're rational like us. And they can be deterred and they can be contained the way we contained the old Soviet Union with deterrence. Well, maybe they can, but most likely they can't.
So it'll be too late when we realize it didn't work. And then who knows what it'll be. Very, very fascinating. But the whole world must be on edge. That's the sense I get, with Ukraine is just maybe just one of the issues, but I think it can only get worse I don't know. I think Putin's going to go crazy. I think he's already gone berserk. And I don't know if America's right. Maybe Biden is right. Maybe they will throw some atomic weaponry. That would be unbelievable.
I never even fathomed
that it was a deterrent. An atomic bomb is a deterrent. Because Putin's saying it's not a deterrent. He could conceivably use it. That's amazing.
Well, I think he's saying it would be his right to use it if any NATO countries invaded Russia proper. Now, the question
nobody
remains,
wants to invade Russia.
How does he view Ukraine? He views Ukraine as part of Russia. Does that mean if you sent NATO troops in to push Russians out, would that be taken as an invasion of Russia itself? We just don't know what's in his mind.
Yeah, exactly. But there's no relationship to what happened in the time of Hitler with what's happening now with Putin. Because I think it came from a different reason, didn't it? It was the extermination of Jews was Hitler's concept, and I'm not exactly sure what Putin's purpose is. He just wants Ukraine. He wants it back, as if it was always his.
Well, I mean, certainly this idea of total warfare is something that was experienced during World War II, where we're willing to bomb innocent populations. But I don't But no, I don't think that's a good comparison to the Holocaust. I think it's obscene. And when Zelensky makes that comparison to the Holocaust as he's addressing the Israeli Knesset, I think that was very obscene. And people took the pushing back. His only great defense and then he castigates Israel all the time for not providing enough support, because after all, he's the Jewish president of Ukraine. Therefore, that we have identity politics at work there.
Mm-hmm.
The worst kind of identity politics. Yet the same president of the Ukraine never supported Israel when the United Nations was voting against Israel. So And it's also, I think people have to be mindful of the history of the Ukraine, that many Ukrainians during World War II were very much willing to become members of the SS and willingly participate in the execution of Jews. So they were Hitler's willing executioners. So I think, you can understand why some Israelis would want be neutral in this. The principal reason for neutrality for Israel is that it's between a rock and a hard place. It enjoys superiority over Syrian skies, and it wants to have that freedom to move around, to drop bombs on Iranian installations when necessary. In order to do that, it has to have a relationship with Putin. The United States doesn't really understand that, or I think they do. They understand enough to know they don't want Israel to continue doing that. So they're basically getting angry at Israel for not being as supportive of the West as they think it should be. But, if you want to practice real politique, then you have to realize other countries are going to do exactly the same thing.
Exactly. Yeah, I couldn't understand the disconnect there in America with regard to that, because that's Israel's lifeline. They worked out that deal with Russia, and that's the way Israel can respond to what Hezbollah is doing and so on and so forth. And then Putin, it's like, I don't know. And so that's fine. But these are the sort of deals that every country makes, don't they? Some sort of accommodation left and right. And it can change, too.
Every country basically serves its own interests. I don't think there's any country that puts these values of, quote, democracy over their interests. I think that's a nice rallying cry to a certain extent. But the issue is, what sacrifices are you willing to make for those so-called ideals? What cost are you willing to pay? Are you willing to pay the cost of a full-blown nuclear war?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't get that either. So I don't know. I really don't have a clue. Well, listen, let me get going, unfortunately, and I hope to speak to you in about 2 weeks' time. And thanks again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be well. Okay, one second. Yeah, one second. Hi. I didn't realize that you didn't ring, so I didn't know. Okay. Thank you so much. Be well. Thank you. Take care. Okay. Let's just see if we've been able to hold on to the station. We'll see in a moment. Sorry about that. Totally unexpected. All right. Let me just quickly see what we have here, and we may be able to get back on track. So almost time-wise, it worked out pretty good. Because we're about 3 minutes early for the professor. But before we move on, what I wanted to do then is, because it's so important with what the professor has to say, let me just move on to another page. So excuse the delay, and want to get to it here. Bear with me a second. You can read the article, of course, the essay that he wrote. That's online. And just so you're aware, well, first of all, the essay, again, it's called The Elites Couldn't Care Less About Inflation, and it's written by, of course, Oren and Levin Waldman. Now, there are quite a few books that you might be interested in learning about that the professor has done. But first of all, he's got his own website called Labor Econ, L-A-B-O-R, and then the second word, E-C-O-N. So Labor Econ, and you could find him at www.econlabor.com. And you can always reach him at his office at 914-629-6351. Now, he has published a few books. One is called Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, Arguments for a Middle Class. And this is issued by Palgrave, P-A-L-G-R-A-V-E. And another book, of course, Understanding Public Policy in the United States. This one is published by PHAT. And then the one that I was introduced to him through was when I read the Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook, which was published by ABC-CLIO, so ABC-CLIO, and it's part of the American Broadcasting Corporation, and I don't know what CLIO stands for. And then this was an exemplary work, which was in paperback, is when I got it, when it was in paperback, it's called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory, again by Oren M. Levin Waldman. And this was published by Routledge, very esoteric publisher, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, Routledge. And you can find them, of course, like all these books online. And then The Case of the Minimum Wage, A Compelling Policy Model, again written by Oren M. Levin Waldman. And this one is published by the State University of New York Press. And all brilliant work, and it wouldn't be a waste of your time if you had interest in these sort of issues. I think you'll find them very, very compelling. Now, fantastic. I just noticed, because I went on the website, and we have a new advertisers on, so I see that the webmaster's already posted it. He is so unbelievable. I don't know how he does it. He's such a busy guy, and he takes care of us like we were probably one of the most important customers around. I guess that's the beauty of really exceptional people. I don't know how he does it. Just brilliant work. Brilliant work. Anyway, I'm always astounded by his work. Anyway, so let me move on to some other things that you might find interesting right now. Bear with me a second here. Okay, we don't need this page anymore. And nor this. I'm trying to get to doing an analysis with you. Let me just see if we can get through to this. Better this way, 1 second. Okay, hopefully this will come through. All right. So we'll catch up with some interesting stuff that's going on. Zelensky evidently says that Russia is blocking Mariupol aid efforts. And seems that the Ukrainian president has accused Russian forces of simply capturing, quote-unquote, refugees, trying to make their way out of the besieged city of Mariupol, where 100,000 people remain trapped. And so there are a couple of issues. President Zelensky has described the attempts to negotiate with Russia as very difficult, quote-unquote. The Ukrainian president has also accused Russia of, quote, capturing, end-quote, refugees. Germany, again, rejects no-fly zone over Ukraine. And Scholz, who is from Germany, and Putin, who is Russia, discuss peace talks between Moscow and Kiev. So German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke to Russian President Vladimir Putin today about Moscow's invasion of Ukraine and the ongoing peace talks between the two sides, Russia said. So meanwhile, Scholz's spokesperson, Stefan Haberstreich, said that the German Chancellor had warned Putin personally against using chemical or biological warfare agents in Ukraine. Scholz has had several phone calls with Putin since the Ukraine war began last month. Addressing the German parliament earlier in the day, Scholz had said that the Russian leader, quote, must hear the truth, end quote, that not only is the war destroying Ukraine, quote, but also Russia's future, end quote. Anatoly Shubay, a special envoy of Russian President Vladimir Putin and veteran Kremlin reformer, has quit his post and reportedly left the country in protest against the Ukraine invasion. Shubay is the first senior Kremlin official to have quit over Russia's war in Ukraine, U.S. news outlet Bloomberg reported, citing unnamed sources. Separately, the Kremlin confirmed the oligarch has stepped down. Shubay resigned at his own request, and whether he left or not is his personal business, Putin press secretary Dmitry Peskov had told the Interfax news agency. He had been Putin's special envoy to international organizations since 2020 and was also one of the principal architects of Boris Yeltsin's economic reforms of the 1990s. Several Russian media said Shubay is in Turkey, and sources told the Reuters news agency he doesn't plan to return to Russia. Well, NATO chief says that the alliance to deploy new battle groups to Eastern Europe are going to take place. Well, NATO nations will agree on, quote, major increases, quote, unquote, in troops stationed in the eastern part of the alliance with the deployment of four new battle groups in Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, and Slovakia, NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg had said. Quote, I expect leaders will agree to strengthen NATO's posture in all domains with major increases in the eastern part of the alliance on land, in the air, and at sea, he said. Now, NATO leaders are gathering in Brussels on Thursday for a summit to discuss the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the way forward for the alliance, saying that NATO has a responsibility to ensure that the war doesn't escalate beyond Ukraine. Stoltenberg also warned Moscow against using weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine, quote, in any use of chemical weapons, any use of chemical weapons would totally change the nature of the conflict. It would be a blatant violation of international law and would have far-reaching consequences, Stoltenberg had said. And then Germany says that more Strela, S-T-R-E-L-A, missiles are on their way to Ukraine. Further supplies of Strela missiles taken from the inventories of the former East German army are to be delivered to Ukraine after a delay, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock had said. The Strela system is a shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile designed to hit low-flying aircraft. The missiles are fitted with passive infrared homing guidance systems and a high-explosive warhead. So far, Ukraine has received 500 Strela missiles, but the delivery up to 2,700 of the weapons has been discussed. Quote, we are one of the biggest weapons suppliers in this situation. It doesn't make us proud, but it's what we must do to help Ukraine, Baerbock had told the Bundestag, that's the government or the parliament. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has caused Germany to change its longstanding policy of not sending weapons to conflict zones. Now, Zelensky is urging Japan to step up sanctions on Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has praised Japan as, quote, the first nation in Asia that started piling pressure on Russia following Moscow's invasion of Ukraine, quote, to continue to impose sanctions, he told the Japanese parliament via video link on Wednesday. Let's make efforts to ensure Russia will want to seek peace. Trade embargoes on Russia must be introduced to stop the tsunami of the invasion against Ukraine, end quote. And during the speech, Zelensky also warned of the dangers his country faced from Russian attacks on nuclear plants and the site of the Chernobyl meltdown. Furthermore, he criticized the ineffectiveness of the United Nations system to stop the invasion, quote, neither the United Nations nor the UN Security Council have functioned. Reforms are needed, end quote, the Ukrainian leader said. Meanwhile, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said he planned to unveil more support measures for Ukraine and strengthen Tokyo's sanctions against Russia at a G7 meeting in Brussels next week, or rather this week. Ukraine's Minister of Parliament says no compromise with Putin on territorial integrity. Well, Ukrainians will not step back from the war, no matter the destruction wrought upon them, said Andriy Osadchuk, the member of the Ukrainian parliament for the opposition party. Quote, Ukraine is resisting. We know how to fight. We burned Russians on the ground extremely well almost a month of war. In a month of war, Russians are stuck almost in all points of the front line. Describing it as a full-scale, terrible war, the Minister of Parliament said it's not correct to blame Vladimir Putin alone because thousands and thousands of Russian soldiers are also involved in attacks on Ukraine. All of them are committing crimes against humanity, war crimes, he said. Osadchuk also stressed the need for a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Quote, we will fight until the end. Our big problem for today is protecting of Ukrainians from Russians in the sky. They are not able to move on the ground. They are not able to kill Ukrainian soldiers. They are killing civilians, and they are taking us by cruise missiles and jet fighters. That's why we need more help from the West to protect our skies. We are repeating this for 4 weeks already. That's the only option. Scholz said that he again rejects no-fly zone over the Ukraine. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has reiterated that Berlin will not support a no-fly zone over Ukraine or send troops to intervene in the war launched by Russia. Quote, NATO will not become a party to the war. We are in agreement on this with our European allies and the United States, he told German lawmakers. Well, Scholz said that Germany would also not impose an embargo on Russian oil, coal, and gas. He stressed that Europe will end its energy dependence on Russia, but to do so from one day to the next would plunge it into an economic recession, risking mass unemployment and entire industrial sectors. Quote, sanctions should not hurt European states harder than the Russian leadership, Scholz had said. The German chancellor also underlined that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has stalled. Putin's offensive is stuck despite all the destruction that it is bringing day after day, Scholz had said, adding that the Russian leader, quote, must hear the truth, end quote, that not only is the war destroying Ukraine, quote, but also Russia's future. The UN is taking up 3 resolutions on Ukraine humanitarian crisis. Well, the United Nations will face 3 resolutions today on the worsening humanitarian situation in Ukraine. While the 193-member General Assembly is scheduled to start considering 2 rival resolutions on Wednesday morning, the Security Council will vote on the 3rd resolution, which is sponsored by Russia and widely slammed for not referring to its invasion of Ukraine. The 2 resolutions being taken up by the General Assembly demand humanitarian aid access and the protection of civilians, medical personnel, and aid workers in Ukraine. Only one text written by Ukraine and its allies criticizes Russia's role in creating the crisis. The 2nd draft from South Africa makes no mention of Russia. Well, there are 9 humanitarian corridors for refugees, which has been agreed to. Ukrainian Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk said on Wednesday that agreements have been made to evacuate trapped civilians from Ukrainian towns through 9, quote, humanitarian corridors, end quote. In the besieged city of Mariupol, Vereshchuk said that evacuees would find transport in the city of Berdyansk, which is more than about 50 miles to the southwest. About 24 buses were also ready to be sent to the southern Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia, she said. And furthermore, humanitarian corridors are planned from the towns of Poloi and Huliapole to Zaporizhia. And 3 routes are planned near the capital of Kyiv, from Velika Dmirka, neighboring Bodanivka and Svitilnia, and people are also brought to the capital suburb of Bovary, while people from Borodyanka, located northwest of Kyiv, are to be evacuated to Bila Tserkva, a city in the center of Ukraine. And 2 corridors are planned in the region of Luhansk in eastern Ukraine, from Lubishny to Nizhnye to Bakhmut. Well, Vietnam Airlines is going to suspend flights to Moscow. The national carrier of Vietnam is to suspend flights from Hanoi to Moscow for March 25, according to state-run Vietnam news agency VNA. The agency reports that the temporary suspension was due to review procedures, requirements, and regulations for operations in Russia. The countries have close ties which date back to the Soviet era, and Hanoi has not condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Zelensky is accusing Russian forces of capturing Mariupol refugees. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Russian forces of simply capturing quote-unquote refugees trying to make their way out of the besieged city of Mariupol on a previously agreed route. Zelensky said that 7,000 people were able to escape over the past 24 hours, but claimed one group traveling the route was taken captive. Zelensky said in a video message that there were 100,000 people who remain in the port city on the Sea of Azov, without food, without water, without medicine, under constant shelling. Tens of thousands of people have already escaped the city. He also accused Russian forces of blocking a humanitarian convoy trying to reach the city on Tuesday and taking rescue workers and drivers. There were about 450,000 people living in the city before Russia invaded. Quote, we're trying to organize stable humanitarian corridors from Mariupol residents, but almost all of our attempts, unfortunately, are foiled by the Russian occupiers by shelling or deliberate terror, Zelensky had said. Human Rights Watch described the city as a freezing hellscape riddled with dead people and destroyed buildings. The United States military says that Russia is bombing the city with artillery and long-range missiles fired from naval ships. Well, peace negotiations are difficult, says Zelensky. Ukrainian President Zelensky has described attempts to negotiate peace with Russia as, quote, very difficult, end quote. Zelensky made the comments in a video address released early on Wednesday. Quote, they are very difficult, sometimes scandalous, but we are moving forward step by step, Zelensky said, and added that Ukrainian officials were negotiating on a daily basis. Quote, we will work, we will fight as much as possible until the end. Brave and open, Zelensky said. The Ukrainian leader has indicated a willingness to hold direct talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but there has been no response to his dialogue or request for dialogue. Mariupol is a city decimated but not giving up. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine enters its fourth week, attacks on the civilian population are increasing. While residents flee Mariupol in droves, Kyiv has ruled out surrender of the beleaguered city. A Russian accused of destroying Chernobyl laboratory. Well, the agency responsible for managing the Chernobyl exclusion zone has accused Russian forces of destroying a new laboratory at the nuclear power plant. Ukraine's state agency for exclusion zone management said that Russian troops had illegally seized, quote-unquote, the laboratory, and then said they robbed and destroyed the November Central Analytical Laboratory. The agency said the laboratory contained highly active samples and samples of radionuclides that are now in the hands of the enemy, which we hope will harm itself and not the civilized world. The facility was built at a cost of 6 million euros, at $6.6 million, with the help of the European Union. It had been in operation since 2015. After weeks of bombardment by Russian forces, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told the Italian parliament there is, quote, nothing left, end quote, of the post city of Mariupol. Now, the United Kingdom's defense ministry of defense said that Ukrainian forces continue to repulse Russian attempts to take over the southern port city of Mariupol. The Ukrainian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said 300,000 people in the Russian-occupied city of Kherson are running out of food and medical supplies. President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine was willing to consider dropping its demands for full NATO membership in exchange for security guarantees. United Nations Refugee Agency said that more than 3.3 million Ukrainian refugees have poured into neighboring countries since Russia's invasion on February 24. And a senior U.S. defense official said that Russia's combat power in Ukraine has dipped below 90% of its pre-invasion level, pointing to the possibility of heavy losses and rising casualties. Oh, so, one second. One second. Okay, I think that this was done before, so bear with me a moment. One second here. And this is interesting. Ukrainian Jews are seeking refuge in Israel. The Israeli government is preparing for a wave of refugees from Jewish communities in Ukraine as people flee war there, with 200,000 Ukrainian Jews eligible for emigration to Israel. It seems to have already begun. A small four-star hotel near the central bus station in West Jerusalem has become a temporary home to Ukrainians fleeing the war back home. For some, it is their first time in Israel. For others, such as Yulia Rabenko and her teenage son Kirill, they're returning after past visits. Regardless, none imagined they would come to Israel under these circumstances with barely anything prepared for a longer stay. Israel is a good country. It's a country of our dreams, perhaps, but I want to come here in a normal way, not like this, but with a whole family, said Rabenko in the lobby of the hotel. Her husband had to stay behind in Ukraine due to the military draft, while the family had previously contemplated immigrating to Israel and had already sent their eldest son there. It was not something they planned to undertake so soon. For me, it was a very difficult decision to go, Rabenko had said. I thought I could stay, but all these air raid sirens came more often, and my son didn't always want to go to the shelter, she says. The English teacher still grapples with making sense of what upended her life and that of her family and friends, who are now scattered across Ukraine, Poland, Germany, and Israel. Like others, Rabenko, her younger son, and their orange tabby cat made the dangerous journey by bus from their hometown city of Cherkasy, about 124 miles south of Kyiv, to the Romanian border. It was one bag for me, one bag for my son and our cat. He is part of the family, she says. It's very difficult when you lose everything in one day. Volunteers helped them in Romania, and members of the Jewish community set them up in a hotel for 5 days. The plan was to stay in Romania, close to home, but the journey continued to Israel. For now, they appreciate the safety and support here, with no documents, neither for my cat nor for my son, but we are in Israel, she says. Rabenko continues to teach English classes online, with her pupils now scattered in various locations, including some still in Ukraine. Eventually, she and her family want to go back to Cherkasy when the war comes to an end. All here at the hotel have had their lives suddenly uprooted. Many of those who sought refuge in Israel came under Israel's law of return, which grants entry on grounds of Jewish ancestry. The law allows people who are born Jewish, along with their spouses or someone with at least one Jewish grandparent, the right to make aliyah or to immigrate to Israel. This Monday, the Jewish agency, which assists with aliyah immigration, announced that it intends to ease bureaucracy in this typically lengthy process. The Aliyah Express program will allow refugees to board flights before they have definitive certification that they are eligible. Agency staff and other organizations are already on the ground in Poland, Romania, Moldova, and Hungary to help refugees, according to the agency. Currently, 4,500 refugees have been set up in hotels in countries neighboring Ukraine and are awaiting flights to Israel, an official said. In light of the conflict in Ukraine, the Israeli government is preparing for a fresh wave of immigrants in what it calls Operation Israel Guarantees. Ukraine and Russia are still home to large Jewish communities. An estimated 200,000 Ukrainians are considered eligible for immigration to Israel. In the 1990s, more than a million people made aliyah after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989. Israeli officials have suggested that they now expect more immigrants from Russia as living conditions could deteriorate. While the debate over non-Jewish refugees, Israel's government has come under fire for its initial policies regarding non-Jewish arrivals from Ukraine, which involved frequent backtracking and strict rules. Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked had set a controversial quota restricting such entries to 5,000. After public outcry, the government announced that any relatives of Israelis could enter with no numerical cap. Under current plans, another 20,000 Ukrainians who lived in Israel before the war, some of them illegally, will be granted temporary stays. The Ukrainian embassy in Israel called upon Israeli policymakers to show more compassion by relaxing entry requirements for those who have relatives or friends willing to host them. We ask for your help, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is Jewish, said in his virtual address to Israeli lawmakers on Sunday. Even for basic visas, as of this week, more than 15,000 Ukrainians have entered the country since the beginning of the war, including 4,400 who are eligible under the Israeli law of return, according to the Immigration Authority. And life is or has been upended. Also among the arrivals are Alexandra Rotenberg. She also goes by Sasha, who is Jewish on her mother's side, along with her partner, Vladimir Rotenberg, and their cat, Bowie, who was too skittish to come downstairs and be photographed. They arrived in Israel on a special evacuation flight from Warsaw at the beginning of March after a long and dangerous journey by train. Back home in Kyiv, the pair worked in social research and co-founded a non-governmental research center. For the time being, both seek academic opportunities in Israel. We don't think too much about our losses. Not enough time has passed by, Vladimir Rotenberg had said. We have only two bags and the bag for the cat and live in hotels, he says. Now we try to make something normal. It's like we put up a psychological defense, he says. We might understand it in 1 or 2 months. A few universities and colleges have said they will set up special fellowships for Ukrainian researchers like Sasha and Vladimir Rotenberg, but the couple's thoughts continue to return to those who stayed behind, including one of their close friends. We try to support them, but over the long distance, it is very difficult. We can just call or send messages, said Sasha Rotenberg. In such extreme moments, one would just like to be able to say, it is going to be okay, but of course it is not. Also, Jewish refugee children from Ukraine are arriving in Berlin as well. Unbelievable. And this is really unbelievable, too. Poland's open-door policy is helping Ukrainian refugees build new lives. Poland is allowing millions of Ukrainians fleeing the war access to the labor market and to health and social benefits. Polish officials are struggling to register and help all the people arriving in the country. For Ukrainian refugees in Poland these days, the most important word is PESEL, the abbreviation for the Polish National Identity Number. Poland's government has promised refugees from neighboring Ukraine that they can stay in the country for up to 180 days and access the labor market, healthcare system, and social benefits. Refugees need a PESEL number for that. Polish authorities set up one of the biggest registration centers so refugees can apply for a PESEL number at the National Stadium in Warsaw. On Friday evening, a day before the center opened, long lines had already formed outside the building. Flasks full of hot tea were provided for the people waiting at the gate to the stadium. I will wait here as long as necessary. I need a work permit. I need to find work, and I need to do it as soon as possible, 24-year-old Victoria told Deutsche Welle. Well, the IT specialist from Kiev was allowed to go in at 9 a.m. the following day. During the night, she's standing in line with her friends and sleeping in a car in the stadium's parking lot. Victoria's persistence paid off. She's hoping to get the PESEL number within a few days. Others aren't so lucky. Anyone who got to the stadium after 7 in the morning, bear with me a second, had no chance of being served the same day. Volunteers had prepared purple wristbands and handed them out to those who were guaranteed to get their turn the next day. Well, the accumulated data is higher than the total number of refugees fleeing Ukraine presented above, since it was taken into account to people across the border between Romania and Moldova. So people from Ukraine, and the issue is where are they fleeing to? So 3 million, almost 400,000 are fleeing Ukraine. As they've moved to Moldova, 362,000. Romania, 528,000. Hungary, 306,000. Slovakia, 246,000. Poland, 2,051,000. And Belarus, 2,500. So there are currently over 2 million Ukrainian refugees in Poland. Some 123,000 received PESEL numbers within the first 2 days of the registration drive. And additional registration points, such as the one at the National Stadium and registration buses that travel to refugee shelters, should speed up the operation. City and municipal offices, which typically issue the national identity numbers, are overwhelmed. In the Polish city of Przemysl, near the Ukrainian border, the city office is working at full speed, but with only 4 fingerprint machines and a total of 7 officers, there are long waiting lines there as well. Oksana Kolesnik used to work as a bank clerk in Ukraine. I don't speak Polish, and I expect it probably won't be possible to work at the bank, she told the news agency, but I need to find some kind of work quickly to secure a living for my son and me. Kolesnik took her passport with her when she fled Ukraine, making the formalities easier. Those who escaped the war without proof of identity also receive refuge in Poland, but registering and receiving an ID number takes longer. Refugees face an uncertain future. A law recently passed by the Polish Parliament ensures refugees' access to the labor market, health care, and social benefits, including monthly child benefits of $120 per child. New arrivals from Ukraine receive the equivalent of 70 euros rather, in welcome money, after which they have to fend for themselves. The new law also guarantees Polish citizens who host Ukrainians the equivalent of 9 euros a day for expenses. Alexandra Stefanik from Lviv sits in the waiting room while her Polish relative, Leon Botnik, helps her fill out the application. The logistics entrepreneur from Przemysl is taking care of his Ukrainian relatives in a recently inherited apartment that had been empty. I suddenly got a call from my mother's sister from Ukraine. She asked me if I could host her and her immediate family. There's only one right answer to that, Bortnick told. He wants to help Stefanik find a job and knows many people in the region. For Stefanik, who is 46, her own future is highly uncertain. I'm confused. I have no idea what to do in Poland. Should I look for work? But I do hope that the war will be over soon and that I can return home, she says, adding that her husband stayed in Lviv and she never planned to leave Ukraine. Arrival of refugees is a new phenomenon in Poland. Since the war started, 3.3 million Ukrainians have emigrated, many to Poland. Even before that, the country of 38 million people had more than a million Ukrainian migrants who left their country since the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014. In 2021, 90% of respondents in a survey by the University of Warsaw Center for Prejudice Research said they accepted Ukrainians as colleagues and neighbors. In recent decades, migrants in Poland have accounted for a small fraction of society. Apart from the Ukrainian emigrants since 2014, there is no other migrant group of comparable size. Compared to other European Union countries, Poland has closed itself off to migrants. The current arrival of refugees is a completely new phenomenon. After more than 3 weeks of an outpouring of solidarity, during which Ukrainian war refugees were welcomed with open arms, questions are emerging in the media of how the already overburdened social and healthcare systems can serve millions more people. Concerns are also growing among some parent associations about the prospect of overcrowded school classes. Agnieszka Lada Kornfeld, the deputy director of the German-Poland Institute in Darmstadt, speaks of an enormous challenge for the administration and society that will irrevocably change the country. Poles will have to learn to live together with people who are somewhat different, the political scientist advised, adding it was an experience that many people already had with Ukrainians taking refuge in the country in recent years. School children will also have to learn to adapt to classmates with a different language and culture as well as different experiences of war, she said. Children, young people will have to cope with that, said Lada Kornfeld. We will have to learn to live with others, to open up. That is part of development. But parts of society may feel overwhelmed by the number of refugees, and more migration from Ukraine could also be used by populists to spread hatred and resentment, the political scientists had said. So if the costs are high and the crisis and the war drag on for a long time, it's hard to say whether Polish society will be able to accept this and learn to live with it, Lada Kornfeld had, said. Well, that's all the time I have for you today, unfortunately, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. And that's it. I have to run. So just take care, and thanks for being with us today. What an absolute pleasure. Okay, I think we go here. Yeah, here we are. We'll say goodbye.